John Singleton Copley's name is synonymous with revolutionary era America. In Boston, where the painter spent his youth, a prominent square is named for him, and the world's largest collection of his work is housed in the Museum of Fine Arts. Copley painted the most famous portraits of Boston's most famous revolutionaries, Paul Revere and Mercy Otis Warren, Samuel Adams and John Hancock. Yet as Jane Kamensky makes clear in her new history, A Revolution in Color, the world of John Singleton Copley, Copley never set foot in the United States. The name of the book is A Revolution in Color. Jane Kamensky is a professor of history at Harvard University, and it's a great pleasure to welcome her to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Joe. I'm really happy to talk to you.
A great pleasure to have you on the program. What brought you to this particular subject?
I had been looking for a long time for a project that could connect art and the national identity of the early American Republic. And I had actually tested a couple of possible lead figures in such a study, including Gilbert Stuart, who we all know is the painter of the George Washington that we have on the $1 bill in all of our wallets. And as I was working on that study, the first thing that changed was that London before the Revolution and during the Revolution came to seem more important in this art and identity question than the United States after the Revolution. And the second thing that I noticed, almost by happenstance, because historians like to work by serendipity, is that Copley was the one who sort of intruded on every frame in every scene, not only because of his painted work, which everybody in New England has the mind's eye picture of Paul Revere from his large Copley's large opus, but also because, almost unique among artists, Copley wrote a ton. It's part of his sort of anxious, questing, ambitious personality, we might almost say an American personality, that he searched for himself in letters and unfolded himself in letters. So it's less that I came to Copley than Copley came to me that way.
The thing that you point out in this book is that of the people that he painted, Paul Revere, Samuel Adams, Mercy Otis Warren, John Hancock, what gave him that access and allowed him to do that, given that we think of him as an American painter, but he wasn't?
Well, I mean, you've just named the four portraits that line the left wall of the Museum of Fine Arts Boston,
right.
Revolutionary Boston Gallery. None of them were Americans, right? They were Americans only in the sense that America was their region of Britain at the time that Copley painted them in the 1760s. They became, in retrospect, patriots and revolutionaries, but at the time he painted them, they weren't a party. They were some of his hyphenated British American neighbors. And as the 1760s progressed, fluid lines of allegiance around political questions and imperial questions with taxes like the Sugar Act and then the Stamp Act and finally the sort of fissure-making Tea Act divided them so that he came to seem British American in a different way that they came to seem British American. But when you look forward instead of backwards in time, which is one of the things that I really want to do very insistently through Copley's eyes in this book, they were just people who wanted portraits. They were the echelon of society who could afford to have a portrait painted, except possibly for Adams, who may have been paid for by somebody else. We don't know much about the making of that portrait. And they commissioned not only the best portraitist in Boston, but surely the best portraitist painting on the western side of the Atlantic at the time that they all sat to Copley between 1763 and about 1770.
You do point out in the book he was born poor and that family politics further complicated his position, didn't it?
Yes, I think one of the things that he shows us that transcends his age is that marriage is a really important determinant of the shape of a life for male figures as it is for female figures in biography. So he's born quite lowly, as you said. I think the family really struggles in his early years. One of the things that shapes him is the need to make a living and acquire what he would have called a competence to shift for his widowed mother and younger brother. And he does well enough to marry better, a sort of time-tested strategy at the time that Copley wed, which was 1769, is to marry up. You know, we have the fictional plot device from the 18th century to now about the poor, benighted woman who marries down. For every woman who marries down, there was a man who married up. And Copley married up, the daughter of one of the wealthier West Indies merchants in the town of Boston, Richard Clark. It was a very fortunate thing to do. Many things came to him with that marriage. Land comes to him. Most of what we now know as Beacon Hill, 22 acres, was part of Copley's estate assembled after his marriage. We know that enslaved people came to him with that marriage. We know that a higher class of portrait sitters came to him with that marriage. He really moved up. But just as you suggested, the other thing that came to him with that marriage was a political allegiance that he could not have expected. So among the things that Copley's father-in-law sold was tea. And they were one of the families that were fortunate enough to get a special consignment license from the East India Company in the summer of 1773, when it would have been reasonable to think that that was a very lucky outcome indeed. And of course, it didn't turn out that way, so that in December of 1773, when a band of patriots disguised as Mohawks dumped 347 chests of tea into Boston Harbor, the plurality of that tea belonged to Copley's father-in-law. And then they really were persona non grata in the town. I think one of the things his stories recalls for us that we don't often admit in the United States is the violence that leads up to the American Revolution. You know, Copley's father-in-law and brothers-in-law are virtual prisoners on the island fortress in the middle of Boston Harbor, Castle William. They're threatened with tarring and feathering, if not worse, you know, ritualized, if not actual violence, if they ever come to town. In the spring of 1774, the mob comes to Copley's house seeking connections of his family and saying that they'll pull the house down. Copley thinks he and his family would have been murdered if the person were in the house. So he doesn't know that he's marrying that set of allegiances in 1769. But when push comes to shove, his party is his family.
You make the point that when he later told the story of his flight to Europe, that the claim that he made was that he was pulled and not pushed, that he went there for art's sake, and basically saying there wasn't a lot to see in this America. How true was that?
Well, I think one of the things that Copley's life reminds us is that the Revolutionary Era is a period in which we need to hold multiple truths at the same time. So it is certainly true that there is not much to see in British America. He goes, in some way, his trip to Europe in the spring of 74 is like the moment in The Wizard of Oz where we go from black and white to technicolor. He grew up in a world of engravings, and he sought a world of paintings. And of course, there were paintings in Boston, and there were isolated old masters and copies people had painted and brought back. But there was no gallery culture, no great houses with major collections, certainly no museums. You know, he really couldn't see in color until he left. And he had been planning to leave for a study trip for 10 years, if not more, by the time he actually shoved off. it was very important for him to say that this was a return to the imperial center, a return to the world of color in Europe, and not as so many other loyalists faced an exile. And yet both of those things were true at the same time. He couldn't have stayed with his family. I think he certainly couldn't have stayed with his father-in-law, nor could he have left with a kind of overt political statement that would have resulted in the loss of that enormous Beacon Hill property. So he was really threading a needle in political and social reality as well as in his own mind. I think he certainly believed that he was pulled rather than pushed, and there's a wonderful line in one of his letters where he says, you know, could any time have been better than the time of my leaving Boston? Because if I had left earlier, I would have had to make a real decision about whether to come back or not. But now there is no choice left. This was very striking to me when I read it, because I think in the United States, we're a nation that loves to make choices, right? We chose ourselves into being. And here's one of our founders of our visual tradition saying that the great joy was having all the choice taken away from him. I think that wouldn't be so important if it weren't the story of very many people, very many more ordinary people than Copley wound up being. He was thrilled not to have to make a choice.
Right. So we slowly reclaimed him as one of our great painters and one of those great, well, really, first American artists.
And I think we like to believe that his work is in an American idiom. And I'll come back to Paul Revere, since it's something that we see not only on posters and in the MFA, but a sort of Bowdlerized version every time you pick up a bottle of Sam Adams, right? Sam Adams is modeled on Copley's Paul Revere on the beer trademark.
Right.
And we like to think that there's a particular Americanness about work like that. It stares right at you, a plain man in shirt sleeves, someone who doesn't dress himself up beyond his station, who's unashamed of working with his hands. All those come to be seen as real American characteristics, and the sort of plain mirror-like quality, seeming mirror-like quality of the art comes to seem American. I think from Copley's perspective, if he could reflect back on the Revere portrait in particular, it contains a lot of the provincialism that he was dying to get away from. You know, when his work first hung in London, and he was still here, one of the people who he was confused with, nobody knew who had painted this picture, Boy with a Flying Squirrel, and he was confused with another provincial artist from Derbyshire, another young provincial painter, because of the almost photorealism of the work. He couldn't wait to get away from that style of painting. He had to see other styles in order to learn how to do it. So it's ironic that his American work comes to be celebrated as the best that anyone would ever want to do, when he surely would not have felt that he had done his best work in British America.
The biography and history is amazing and really fascinating. It's A Revolution in Color, The World of John Singleton Copley. The book is published by Norton. Jane Kamensky, I thank you very much for being with us this morning. Best of luck with the book, and thank you so much for spending time with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Joe. It was great to talk to you.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is A Revolution in Color, The World of John Singleton Copley. Jane Kamensky is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.